Hello. The West African city of Timbuktu has for centuries housed some of the most valuable intellectual treasures of the Islamic Golden Era. Many thousands of manuscripts have been preserved in Timbuktu, not only as historical relics, but also as an important Malian cultural inheritance, representative of the city's identity as an historic crossroads of culture and intellectual discourse. Philosophy, law, theology, geometry, and history are only a handful of the vast array of subjects contained in the body of these manuscripts. We'll be talking about a daring exploit to rescue these precious documents from destruction during the occupation of Timbuktu by Al-Qaeda forces, and we'll be learning more about the history of the city and its role as an information hub. I'm Catherine Reed, and joining me today is Elodie Dupont, professor of history at Université Paris-Sorbonne. Mélanie Kayne-McLeese is professor of anthropology at Oxford University, and Mary Sensmaker is a metadata librarian at the Hill Museum and Manuscript Library at St. John's University, Minnesota. Mary Sensmaker, why don't you start us off? Could you tell us what are the Timbuktu manuscripts and why are they so important?
Well, we're talking about tens of thousands of manuscripts. Many of them are medieval. About 340,000 were saved by evacuation from Timbuktu to Bamako. Historically, the city is an ancient crossroads. It became an intellectual center in the 12th century that flourished well until the end of the 17th century, when it was home to approximately 180 universities. It was home to an intelligentsia that produced writings on many subjects, including poetry, mathematics, animism, Islam, history, philosophy, astronomy, physics, chemistry, medicine, botany, geography, even erotica. So they represent a huge body of ancient knowledge.
No, but before we get to their subject matter, can you bring us back to the manuscripts themselves for a minute? What are they like physically?
Well, for the most part, the manuscripts themselves are unbound. They're mainly in codex form, not in scrolls, and they're kept in leather slip cases and tied together with ribbons. They come in a rich variety of calligraphic forms. Many of them are elaborately illuminated with colored ink and gold leaf. In addition to paper and papyrus, they come in many exotic forms of parchment, using the skins of camel, antelope, and fish, for example. The majority of them are in Arabic, but many of them are also in other local languages such as Songhai, Tamashek, and Bambara. Of course, print is known in Mali, but even today it's unpopular. There's a tendency, a tradition to copy even modern texts into manuscript form.
I see. Now, can you tell us about the subject matter? Why are these manuscripts so important to the Malian culture and their intellectual history in particular?
The manuscripts represent a literate culture that's often been ignored in European accounts of African history. The supposed absence of books in Africa, after all, has historically been used by Enlightenment philosophers such as Hume, Kant, and Hegel as a justification for theories of racial inferiority and for slavery itself. The manuscripts are a priceless world treasure. Golden Age Timbuktu was a cosmopolitan city with a lively, progressive intellectual culture. Even in the day of Leo Africanus in the 16th century, Timbuktu's version of Islam was never very strict. The manuscripts reveal a secular curiosity and open-mindedness that defies the Western stereotype of Islam based on religious extremism. And of course, the tolerance that the manuscripts represent is exactly why these collections would be extremely vulnerable under Sharia rulers, who would see them as heresy. They've survived largely because Malians have a long history of hiding manuscripts from repressive rulers and threatening invaders.
Elodie Dupont, can you give us some of the background of what was happening in Mali and Timbuktu leading up to the 2012-2013 book rescue?
Well, living in northern Mali are mostly Tuareg people who were divided between five countries during the colonial period. They've long argued for an independent state of their own, and there's a history of conflict between the Tuareg people and the Malian state. In 2012, there was a rebellion in the north, and a Tuareg rebel group called the National Movement for the Liberation of Azawad, which is the local name for the region, they took control of northern Mali. This group allied itself with an Al-Qaeda-linked extremist group named the Ansar al-Din, and they took over many cities in northern Mali, including Timbuktu. However, the Ansar al-Din quickly abandoned their association with the Tuareg rebel group, and they instituted strict Sharia law in the areas they occupied. During this occupation, the Ansar al-Din destroyed many historical sites in northern Mali. In Timbuktu, the Ansar al-Din took over the Ahmed Baba Institute, a library which housed more than 300,000 of the manuscripts we are talking about, which were evacuated in 2012 and 2013. Ultimately, the Ansar al-Din did burn this library, although the only manuscripts that were destroyed by this were the ones located in the same room that the extremists slept in, thanks to the rescue efforts. In 2013, Mali appealed to France for aid, and by the end of January, the combined efforts of the French and Malian militaries had reclaimed the cities taken by the extremists, including Timbuktu. Unfortunately, the political situation in Mali remains unstable today.
That's very true. Now, Melanie K. McLeese, I'm sure our listeners are keen to know about this brilliant and really perilous rescue. What happened?
The story of the Timbuktu manuscripts is really quite remarkable. The main driving force behind the rescue of the manuscripts was Abd al-Qadir Hidara. On March 30, 2012, Islamist Tuareg rebels seized Timbuktu. Fearing that the rebels would destroy the libraries and collections, Hidara knew he needed to move manuscripts out of the libraries. He used funds from his own library to purchase 2,400 metal trunks to store the manuscripts. Over 3 months, Hidara and volunteers snuck into the library at night to fill the trunks with manuscripts, then snuck the trunks to safe houses in Timbuktu. At the end of July in 2012, the Al-Qaeda-linked Islamist group Ansar al-Din chased the Tuaregs out of Timbuktu and instituted a strict and brutal Sharia law. Violence and the destruction of culturally significant sites in Timbuktu heightened, and Hidara knew the manuscripts were no longer safe in the city. He recruited hundreds of volunteers to be couriers, mostly teenagers so that they would not be recognized, to smuggle the trunks 606 miles from Timbuktu to Bamako, Mali's capital. They rented hundreds of trucks, four-wheel drive vehicles, and taxis. In October 2012, the volunteers began their journeys to Bamako. The trunks were often concealed under crates of produce. They ran into trouble at border crossings, and on a few occasions, the couriers were taken into custody, and Hidara, by phone, had to arrange cash bribes for them to be released. In March 2013, rebels blocked all roads in and out of Timbuktu. In a desperate last resort effort, Hidara and the librarians, who helped organize the rescue, transported the last 791 footloggers down the Niger River in pirogues, which are West African canoes. Each river trip was a two-day journey. Remarkably, 95% of the manuscripts in the Ahmed Baba Institute were saved, which is an incredible feat.
Incredible indeed. And how was all of this funded?
Before the evacuation, Hidara had secured donations from many international foundations to finance the libraries, including $600,000 from the Ford Foundation. He also had donations to Great Britain, Germany, the Netherlands, Dubai, and notable families from Kuwait and Saudi Arabia. There was also a $60,000 donation made from a Kickstarter campaign and $255,000 from the Dutch National Lottery. And all of these donations were wired through a bank in Cleveland, Ohio.
It's just astounding. Elodie DuPont, are there any international laws in place to respond to such threats to cultural heritage as these?
There are a number of laws and conventions relevant to this situation. A prominent example is the 1954 Hague Convention for the Protection of Cultural Property in Armed Conflict. Mali is a state party to the Hague Convention and its first protocol, which allows for the prosecution of state parties for the deliberate destruction of cultural property. However, the Ansar al-Din are not internationally recognized as a state, and therefore they cannot be prosecuted under this protocol. The Hague Convention's second protocol, which was adopted in 1999, the second protocol includes provisions for the prosecution of individuals and non-state actors for the destruction of cultural property, and this is how the Ansar al-Din would be classified. Unfortunately, Mali was not at the time party to the second protocol. Mali may have other options, however. Mali is signatory to the 1998 Rome Statute, which includes provisions enabling the International Criminal Court to prosecute crimes against cultural property.
Well, then we shall see what unfolds in the international courts. Mary Sensemaker, let's close with the scrolls. What's being done with them now?
Well, 95% of the 377,000 manuscripts from Timbuktu's libraries were successfully evacuated, and they're now in storage in Bamako. I'm in Bamako to help as a metadata librarian with the Hill Museum and Manuscript Library, one of the project partners along with Cape Town University. We're working with funding from Germany's Gerda Henkel Foundation and a grant from the Prince Claus Foundation for Culture and Development from the Netherlands. We started with just 2 digital cameras, but we're now up to 4 cameras. We don't use ultraviolet scanning technology because it could ignite the linen-based paper and iron-based inks and destroy the manuscripts. We've also begun a sophisticated computerized catalog of the entire collection. We've resumed the preservation and digitization efforts that had already established the Mama Hidara Commemorative Library as one of the most innovative conservation centers in the world.
Well, that was really intriguing. Thank you, everyone, and to our listeners, please join us next week on In Our Time, where we will be discussing the extraordinary pedigree of Her Majesty the Queen's Royal Corgi Fleet.